From Georgia Public Broadcasting, it's On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last month, the FBI and local law enforcement agencies arrested dozens of people in a major sting known as Operation Safe Summer in the metro Atlanta region. 160 missing and exploited children were rescued, some as young as 3 years old. FBI agent Nathan Whiteman headed up the operation and is here to tell us more about it and talk about the growing problem of exploited and trafficked children in Georgia and the rest of the country. Nathan, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So this was a huge operation that I think it's safe to say stunned many people. How long had it been in the works?
We've been planning this for about 6 months prior, trying to reach out to as many law enforcement agencies in the metro Atlanta area to participate in the operation to really look at the problem of crimes against children and exploitation of children.
I'm looking at like 38 agencies that you were working with. That's a lot of coordination. How much resources goes into an operation like this?
For us, it is. We pulled people from headquarters. We had support from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, our headquarters branch, as well as the resources of our squad here in Atlanta.
How many people were arrested in the end?
It was 157 people who we had judicial actions against. I believe of those, there were about 140 actual arrests of people.
So this is called Operation Safe Summer. What's behind that title?
What we looked at is children are being exploited, and there are vulnerable children every single day that law enforcement deals with. What our goal was to try to, before the end of summer, locate as many missing children as possible to get them back home, to identify and locate as many exploited children to be able to either get them back home or to a safe environment where they can go through a therapeutic process. And then also looking at the community and seeing what offenders are out in our communities that we had to kind of take out of our communities or check upon to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing to make our streets safer for our children.
Now, I do want to talk about the therapeutic process in a minute, but I'm curious about summer as a season. You know, kids are not in school. Are they in more danger, less danger? Because I'm hearing now that schools are a big place for recruitment.
There are schools are a big place for recruitment. Whenever you have the children there, they are interacting with each other. Summer is typically a season where children have a little bit more freedom, not as much supervision. So what we're looking at is trying to make those streets safer so parents didn't have to worry as much. And those, the predators that are in the communities would kind of be taken off the streets or put into the judicial process, or we would be able to target them, identify them, and kind of start our investigations that way as well.
How does local law enforcement or the FBI go about conducting these kind of operations? What can you tell us about how they plan this sting?
What we did is we communicated. We had several meetings with local and state law enforcement to kind of plan out what exact targets or what exact issues that we were interested in. So every day we deal with, the local law enforcement deals with molestation complaints or investigations dealing with child molestation, with child neglect. They do alcohol compliance checks. All those things are already in the works with law enforcement at the local level. So what we looked at is trying to combine those efforts, put a little bit more manpower towards those efforts to be able to get as much of an investigation forward as possible to then be able to, kind of put together and quantify that number for us as a total law enforcement here in Atlanta.
So where are you looking for clues? Are you looking at websites? Are you actually staking out areas and watching for people?
We do that. We do that every day.
That's the real FBI of work, right?
Yeah, the real FBI work is we are part of a task force which is called the Metro Atlanta Child Exploitation Task Force, or MATCH Task Force. We have investigators. We have, I think, over 17 agencies and over 15 federally deputized task force officers from local state authorities that are part of our task force that we communicate daily as a whole about what's going on in the different jurisdictions. So we have people out conducting undercover operations daily. We have analysts that are going through different websites that are either putting up photos of children that are used by predators to prey on children, or are also used to advertise sex trafficking.
So where are these children from?
From all over. They're from, we recovered two children from as far away as Toledo, Ohio, who were brought down here during a sex trafficking operation. But when you're dealing with online enticement, production of child pornography, molestation, those children are our neighbors. They are the kid down the street. The perpetrators or the predators and the offenders are also our neighbors and the man or woman down the street. So really what we try to look at is it is not one specific area of Atlanta. It is anywhere and everywhere. And that's where we all have to be, you know, concerned about who our children have access to, who has access to our children, and talking to our children about, you know, what they should keep their eyes open for.
So I think when we see on the news, you know, or hear or read about, there's this sweep. Are there really 160 children in one place that you were rescued?
No, it was not just in one location or one neighborhood. This is a combined effort, really throughout five counties. We dealt, because this is the first year that we did this Operation Safe Summer. So what we started out with was looking at the five major metropolitan counties, Cobb County, Fulton County, Gwinnett County, Clayton County, and DeKalb County. So those law enforcement agencies, as well as our federal partners and state partners, really looked at concentrating right now in those areas. And then in hopes of future years that we put forward what we learned from this operation to expand it and continue to expand it and see if we can do it across the country through the FBI offices.
I'm speaking with Nathan Whiteman. He's an FBI agent who headed up Operation Safe Summer that swept up kids. It was a sting with local law enforcement agencies all across the state, helping to identify and find 160 missing and exploited children. In what kind of conditions were these kids held?
A lot of them were, you know, they're in their own homes. Sometimes they are in hotels. They are part of our community. So it really depends upon what type of operation we conducted during the overarching umbrella Operation Safe Summer. So if it was a sex trafficking operation, a lot of those operations deal with hotels. We have other techniques that we use to be able to find offenders and children. A lot of it is also finding adult human trafficking victims on the internet, through the internet. When we're dealing with child molestation victims, they're being exploited most of the time in their homes behind closed doors. So really with those investigations, we really rely on our hospitals, our community partners to be able to bring those types of investigations to light. And then if it is a missing and exploited or missing or runaway youth, really it is just old school police work of going out and trying to find those children who don't necessarily want to be found before they fall prey to something a little bit more sinister.
And so after you identify them, you find them, what happens to them?
It depends on the situation. The number one thing that we look at is what are their basic needs? Are they safe? Have they been fed? And what are really they need to become successful people? If it is a matter of they can go home and they don't have an offender in the house, a lot of times we will put them back in the home and then follow up with non-governmental agencies to be able to reach back out to them to offer services and support through DFACS, through organizations like For Sarah or through Georgia Cares.
Right. Well, we previously spoke with Katrina Owen. She was a sex trafficking survivor. She lived in Atlanta. She's now an activist who talks about how her trafficker would find new victims.
He would roam the mall, and if he see a young girl that's walking by herself, he would walk up to her and tell her how beautiful her eyes were. And if she looked him eye to eye and said, thank you, he knew that she wasn't the one. And when he would approach a young girl who he would give a compliment to and she would look down at her feet, he knew everything that he needed to know.
Wow. So this is something. I was at the airport yesterday, posters and signs everywhere identifying, you know, if you suspect someone is in human trafficking, you know, there's an outline of a really looks like a young girl with an older man. This is something that, as you pointed out, is going on right in our midst. So what do we do if we suspect something?
There are different hotlines that you can call. You can always call Crime Stoppers if it is something that is an emergency situation. I always suggest calling 911. You can call the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to make a tip. And there's also the National Human Trafficking Resource Center, or Polaris. They have a 800 number that you can also call to call in those tips. And what those larger organizations will do is provide that information to law enforcement. Specific, if it is specific to Atlanta, they will send me that tip, which will then go out to our task force to be able to look into and investigate.
Well, Nathan Whiteman, I mean, you and the people who work on this, you're dealing with some really grim stuff. You've been on the force for 14 years. I'm wondering what brought you to this particular area of FBI investigation.
Prior to being in the FBI, I was a teacher. So I've always, you know, through my educational process in dealing with children, trying to better children, when I entered the FBI, I had the opportunity and the ability to use those prior skills in my current job title. And then what we wanted to do through the Innocent Image or Innocence Lost National Initiative back in 2003 with the FBI, starting these sex trafficking task forces and working groups to be able to work with locals and state officials to be able to tackle this issue.
Katrina Owens also shared a message for parents to be vigilant.
It all boils down into, you know, the validation that children receive or don't receive. And quite often, just in the world that we live in now, parents are working more hours than ever, working multiple jobs. The single parenting homes that exist in our country, there are so many opportunities that are being missed. And as parents, we have to be hypersensitive.
So, message to parents: hypersensitive, hypervigilant. What do you add to that?
I think the biggest thing is everything that she noticed and she said is exactly what we see day in and day out. People always ask me, well, what can I do as a normal citizen? What can I do? A lot of times it is, if you have children, you attend church around children, be that role model, be that person, even if their parents aren't providing that love and support, that nurturing that a child needs, you can be that person to set them on the positive track so they will not fall prey to a trafficker or someone else who can entice them online by providing them with ideas and idealities of love and support that are false.
FBI agent Nathan Whiteman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
He spearheaded Operation Safe Summer, a major undertaking conducted in May to combat child exploitation and sex trafficking. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, it's On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. We continue our conversation about sex trafficking in Georgia. It's a difficult but important subject, given that Atlanta is one of the top 10 markets for human trafficking. Susan Norris is founder of Rescuing Hope, a foundation which hopes to eradicate sex trafficking. Susan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Atlanta is one of the biggest hubs for sex trafficking in America. Why is that?
All of the things that we love about Atlanta, our four sports teams, our international airport, our theme parks that we have, that people travel to Atlanta to come to, they bring an influx of population. And it boils down to a supply and demand issue. When people come in, there is a demand for commercial sex. And so, as one trafficker told me, if we get a call, we answer them all. We may doze, but we never close. So they're going to meet that demand. And we also have three major interstates that travel through our city. And anyone in this industry has a tendency to go from state to state. They don't always keep their trafficking victims in one location because they're constantly looking for where is law enforcement paying attention? Where are they setting the stings? And there's a network. We don't like to think of this as organized crime, but it is. And traffickers communicate with one another. And if one area is getting hot with law enforcement, then they will take their victims and travel elsewhere.
How did you become involved in this?
I was working in student ministry and stepping away from the school that I was volunteering with Fellowship of Christian Athletes when I heard the average entry age into the sex trade at that time was 12 to 14 for girls and 11 to 13 for boys. And that was the age group I just spent 4 years with. So it wasn't a statistic to me. It was actually faces of kids that I'd spent 4 years with. And as I dug into the information and began doing interviews with the victims and families and law enforcement, I realized that some of the very kids that came through our program were victims of sex trafficking in my little bubble where I felt safe. So if it could happen there, it could happen anywhere.
It is staggering to think of children that young being involved in the sex trade. So what does your organization do?
We have three focal points at Rescue and Hope: enlightenment, education, and empowerment. Enlightenment's where we literally travel the country, raising awareness, having community events where we let people know that this issue is going on. It's called the crime hidden in plain sight, and it is. People realize that it's going on in Thailand and Cambodia, but they don't think that it's going on in their zip code, in their backyard, in their child's school. And so we shine the light on that and raise awareness because people won't fight a problem if they don't know it exists. We also, with education, go in and educate first responders. Some of them don't even know they're first responders. It may be a classroom teacher, a counselor, a child psychologist, a school administrator, an ER nurse, the intake information individual for a urgent care. There's been studies done that show that over 80% of trafficking victims saw someone in the medical field for treatment. And at that intersection, no one asked the proper questions to help get them out of the life. So we go in and provide that. Georgia CARES states that of those that they've served that are domestic minor sex trafficking victims, over 90% were in school when they were first approached by their trafficker. Yes.
The school idea is really frightening to me. That's where they get targeted. How?
Honestly, a trafficker goes anywhere your child is. They will be at the mall. They will be at the movies. They will be at the water parks. They go to your child's sporting events, and they sadly might be sitting right beside you because they're looking for their next victim. So they're there, they're cheering, and they're looking for the child who is being left out, the child on the fringe, the vulnerable one as a target. And in some cases, we have worked with individuals where a trafficker would enroll one of their victims in school as a student for the sole purpose of trolling the school, looking for the next person that they could lure into a position of vulnerability. So we have to educate our schools. And then we are also post-certified to train law enforcement, not on statute and code, because they certainly know that, but we come in from a victim perspective because trafficking victims have been told law enforcement is against you. They will arrest you. They will bring harm to you. And so as a result, these victims are not necessarily going to run up to a police officer and say, I'm a victim of sex trafficking. In fact, they will lie and in many cases take charges for their trafficker because they don't trust law enforcement. So we need to go in and help law enforcement understand mentally how someone who's experienced complex trauma may respond to them.
Well, trauma is such a big part of this, but I want to get to that sort of mind control idea. How does that play into, how does a sex trafficker work that in order to control or draw in a kid?
Well, there are three ways that traffickers draw someone into the sex trade or the life or the game. It's referred as all of those things. But as I tell young people, it's not a life you would choose. It's not a game you want to play. And it's nothing you want to be traded for. It's force, fraud, or coercion. And most people, when they think of trafficking, if they realize it happened in the United States, they're thinking of the movie Taken, because that's Hollywood's version of how it happens.
That's the image I have. Grab the girl, put her in the van.
Exactly. And while that does happen, there are some snatch and grabs that do take place in our area. That is not the most common technique. Fraud and coercion are the ways that it is used. Atlanta is known as the hip-hop capital of the world. And so you are looking at people whose mental development is not fully developed, the frontal lobe that causes them to make rational decisions and understand the long-term responses to something that they may do. So they'll be invited to come and be a backup dancer for a new video. And they want their 15 minutes of fame, or one that we saw quite a bit about 2 years ago. Someone will hand out a business card and say, you know, we need a new model. And we had one get sick. We're doing a fashion show at Perimeter Mall. And if you do a really good job here, we'll take you on the road with us and you can do other gigs. And if this person is savvy enough at 12 years old to call the mall, which they probably won't, and ask if there's a fashion show, there is one that weekend, because the best lie has a little bit of truth with it. But the particular modeling agency is not one being represented. And so they will lure them that way, because everyone wants their 15 minutes of fame. The more frightening ways of fraud is the situation where someone has been enrolled in school and they pose as a friend to your child. And they may spend 3 or 4 months building a friendship and building a trust level. And then they invite you to a party or to come spend the night. But what you walk into is not what you thought it was. That party is actually a prearranged gang rape and you're the guest of honor. Or at the spend the night, you go to sleep and you wake up with men in a room and the person you thought was your friend is nowhere to be found.
We're speaking with Susan Norris. She's founder of Rescuing Hope. She's an advocate for sex trafficking victims, but also an author. Is there anything that makes particular girls easier targets? I mean, I'm not in any way blaming the victim, but something either demographic-wise, location-wise, where they are in school, tendencies towards drug or alcohol abuse, any of those?
Well, while honestly, anyone is a potential victim of this, this evil is not a respecter of persons. We've worked with victims who have come from affluent families, divorced families, we've foster care, every demographic that you can imagine. I tell students, if there was a purple polka-dotted race, there would be someone from that trafficked as well. Because to a trafficker, they're not looking for a particular look. They're looking for whatever anyone's going to pay for, because it's all about the money. But what research has shown us is that if you're in a single-parent family, there can be a greater risk. Just the numbers game. You've got one set of eyes versus two watching you, making sure that you're being safe, someone there to supervise, even to monitor your social media and the things that you're doing on the internet, which is the way that a lot of traffickers are luring victims today. We also know from research data that's come out that African-American females are at greater risk, but there are Caucasian females, Indian Asian females, there are male victims, and that's one that most people don't realize. But boys are victims just as well as girls. It may look a little different, but they are also victimized, again, because a trafficker is going to provide whatever the buyer is requesting.
So I'm sure it's difficult to speak of, but is there a story of a particular person who came to your organization and told you what happened to her or him?
Well, we've had countless stories of survivors that have come to us, and we had one particular individual that she was a school student, and she got in trouble with her mother, and they had an argument, and she was grounded to her room, and so she went upstairs, but she still had her appendage, aka her cell phone, with her, and friends were texting her, and she got a message asking if she was going to the party, and she didn't know about a party and started telling them that she was grounded till the end of time and couldn't go anywhere. They were waiting for her father to come home, and this friend said, well, you've got a window, don't you? I can come by and pick you up. So she climbed out and went down to the end of her driveway, and this car pulled up with her friend in it, and a guy driving that she didn't recognize. And they invited her in the car to go to the party, and he offered her a pill to take and said, let's get this party started. And she declined and said she didn't do that. And so he told her, fine, get out of the car. He didn't want to take a party pooper to the party. So she had to either swallow the pill and go on to the party or try and figure out how to get back into her house without her mother knowing that she had left to begin with. And she took the choice that most teenagers would, and she swallowed the pill, and it turned out it was ecstasy, which is the date rape drug. And by the time she got to the party, she did not have a great deal of control over her faculties. And when she went inside, there was no one there that she recognized. There were a bunch of men, and she was the guest of honor, and it was a gang rape, and the man who had driven the car became her trafficker.
As a prevention, as an education advocate, which steps, where would you have interceded or warned a young person not to take that next step?
Well, quite honestly, I always tell people you have that sixth sense where you know that you shouldn't do something, where you get that heart rate going up. You're trying to figure out, how can I get out of this? What can I do? And that is your point of intersection that you can make a choice. And I never blame a victim. No one ever asked to be trafficked. But when we do speak with students and we explain to them what force, fraud, and coercion is, then we go back to those scenarios and tell them, now that you know the story, let's look at the different points of intersection that might have been a place that she could have done something or he could have done something to prevent the next step from happening. And it's, again, it's not the blame game. It's to get students thinking outside of the box so that if they find themselves in a similar situation, they realize they can put on the brakes and find an exit strategy.
In these cases, when you are dealing with people who have been, minors who have been sex trafficked, or even older people, I'm sure, and you integrate them back into society or reintroduce them to their old lives, what is the follow-through like? I mean, I'm thinking that, especially with the symptoms of PTSD, the weight that they're carrying psychologically and physically must be huge.
There's a great deal that needs to take place in the restorative process. We serve those that are over 18, but the vast majority of those that we do serve were trafficked as minors and into adulthood, or they got out just before they turned 18. Some of them will go into a residential restorative care program that may be a year or two. Many of them don't, because that's another form of control, because you have to follow a schedule and do what someone's telling you to do. And they've just come out of that environment, so they don't want to go there. Either way, there is a great deal of physical trauma to the body and complex trauma mentally that they have endured. So we always try and make sure that we get those that we serve into medical care to evaluate their health and see where they are and what they need as far as health care. While we don't have the financial resources at Rescuing Hope to provide that, we have worked and partnered with several doctors and dentists who have been willing to work pro bono and service our survivors as a way for them to step into the fight. As I tell people, you don't have to quit your day job. Look at how you can leverage what you're already doing for this movement. And then we try and find therapists that can work with the survivors on complex trauma and PTSD. And what we have found is they really need to be versed in complex trauma, because someone who is dealing with an addiction can go to an addiction recovery therapist who is may or may not have worked in complex trauma. The same with someone who has experienced rape. While it's very traumatic for them, it's vastly different than someone who's been raped between 10 and 30 times a night for 2 years. So you need someone who has a skill set to unpack all of that. And it is a lifetime of recovery.
That was Susan Norris, founder of Rescuing Hope and author of a book of the same name. There's more information on her organization and resources to help victims of human trafficking at gpbnews.org. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, it's On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report that suicide rates are on the rise, and it's a sad reality highlighted by the high-profile suicides of Chef Anthony Bourdain and fashion designer Kate Spade last week. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about the new report from the CDC, which challenges some of the assumptions many people have about suicide. And we're going to talk about how the media cover these tragedies. We would love to hear from you. Have you tried to help someone you suspect might be suicidal? Did you miss the signs and lost somebody that you know and love? Call us and let us know at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Twitter and on Facebook. And be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 o'clock for more. All eyes are on the Federal Reserve policy meeting that begins tomorrow. Predictions are that the Fed will raise interest rates. America's central bank has a fascinating history with Georgia's Jekyll Island and played an important and very secretive role. Historian June Hall McCash is on the line to tell us more about it. She's professor emerita at Middle Tennessee State University. Hello, June.
Hi. So nice to talk with you, Virginia.
And the Roger Lowenstein is also with us. He's the author, among other books, of America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve. Hello, Roger.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
So, June, a little background first on this meeting at Jekyll Island. What was going on in America's economy back then in 1910?
Well, 1910 had followed the panic of 1907. And there was a great deal of concern about the currency and about stabilizing the currency, because the 1910 meeting took place in an atmosphere of concern about things like money trusts and people who were controlling the majority of the economy, as we find today is the case, but they were very concerned that people not know that they were going to meet, because the people who met at Jekyll Island were a group of politicians and bankers, and this was to be very, very controversial and very secretive. And it started out as a very a totally surreptitious meeting. The people who were chosen, they were six men, all of whom were associated in one way or another with people like John D. Rockefeller, James Stillman, George F. Baker, it was a very
Let me ask Roger to pick it up there and there, because he's also written about this. So the economy is in trouble. There's this idea that some of the wealthy and powerful can help steer it back on course. So, Roger, why did they choose Jekyll Island as a meeting place?
So America was a funny place back then. In some ways, it's still a funny place. America, unlike every developed, what we would have said, civilized country in the world, did not have a central bank. In other countries, they didn't think twice about that. In France and Germany and England, they said, yep, organizing your financial system is as basic as organizing the army under a general or a post office, with the main post office in Paris or Berlin or whatever. But in the U.S., we've always been afraid of large, central, powerful bodies. You know, we've seen that about the healthcare debate. Powerful national organizations frighten Americans. That's our heritage, after all. We rebelled against an English king. So after this panic that June referred to in 1907, some of the leading bankers on Wall Street said, and what had happened then was they turned to J.P. Morgan, the man, who was then in his 70s, to try to bail the country out. It hadn't really worked. They said, this is ridiculous. We've got the leading economy in the world. We're too big to have you know, one grand old guy with a watch chain come in and bail us out every time. We need something like what we now call the Federal Reserve. But they knew that, you know, if you said in the newspapers that some Wall Street bankers and a couple of politicians were designing a new policy, people
right.
would, as we say, they freak out. So they picked a club where J.P. Morgan was a member on Jekyll Island, the hunting club. He made sure to clear everybody else out, and then they went down in secret for a week and mapped out a new program.
So in secret, they were, even from what I read, some senators or members were on one end of a train, another on another end of a train. They had no idea where they were going. So, June, how did they get around this resistance to central banking when they finally met?
Well, actually, they met, as you know, in secret, and they met over a period of we don't know exactly how many days. I know that one source says 9 days, but they were there. They started on November 11th, and they met through Thanksgiving, which fell on November 24th. And we know that they had wild turkey and oyster dressing with their Thanksgiving dinner.
These are important details.
Very important detail, yes. And they put together what was known as the Aldrich Plan. Nelson Aldrich was the father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller, Jr., and he was the person who arranged the meeting. But everyone thinks that James Stillman was probably the person. He was a member of the club as well, and that he was probably in many ways behind this meeting. But they met on Jekyll Island and put together quite surreptitiously. As a matter of fact, as they went down, they even took on false names, with some of them calling each other Orville and Wilbur and all sorts of fake names so that no one would recognize them. And it was not during the club season. They really didn't have to clear out the club because there was no one on the island except the year-round employees and the club superintendent at the time, and obviously a good chef. But they got around it simply by putting together what they call the Aldrich Plan, which actually was brought to Congress and failed in Congress in 1912 under President Taft. But it was revised by a team called Glass-Willis and ultimately was approved in December 23rd, 1913, as the Federal Reserve System under President Woodrow Wilson.
So, Roger, tell us about the Federal Reserve System. How did the plan that these gentlemen came up with and started to lay out there, how did that get around those fears that so many Americans had of a centralized bank?
So the story really starts with Aldrich, as Jude mentioned. He was a fascinating figure. He was a robber baron, also a U.S. senator, very powerful, very rich, very opposed to any sort of reform. But he bumped into a guy named Paul Warburg, who was an emigre banker who'd moved to the U.S. to be with his love, an American woman who he married. And Warburg began to tell him, you know, we don't have to have these panics every few years, which the U.S. had been having in Germany and France, so we don't have them. And late in life, Aldrich, really at Warburg's urging, toured Europe, and he came back a changeling, a convert, and convened this meeting. When they left Jekyll Island, he began to go around and tout what was the Aldrich Plan. But Aldrich, being a very conservative figure, was unpopular. The plan was unpopular. When Woodrow Wilson ran for president, he said to a couple of bankers on the QT, we're going to have the Aldrich, we'll get 80% of the Aldrich Plan, was his exact words, but we'll have to do it under a different name. And that's essentially what happened. Carter Glass, who's known to history perhaps better as the author later of the Glass-Steagall Act, went up to meet with Wilson at his home in Princeton in the president-elect period before Wilson took office. Glass was a Southern Democrat, what we would call a Dixiecrat, very opposed to any kind of federal control of anything. Basically, he didn't want race relations disturbed by the federal government. He didn't want anything disturbed by the federal government. But Warburg had back channels to Wilson. And Wilson not only was a politician, he was, of course, an historian and a professional scholar and academic before going into politics. He knew all about the country's origins. He knew about Alexander Hamilton, who'd formed the first prototype central bank, which hadn't lasted. And Wilson pushed it through.
Well, thank you so much, Roger, for that. We got a little bit of insight on the secret, the furtive meeting of some of the men who helped design the first central bank, the Federal Reserve of the United States. June, thank you so much. June Hall McCash.
My pleasure.
Pleasure talking with you each.
Roger Lowenstein, thank you so much for joining us. We just heard about the undercover origins of the Federal Reserve at Jekyll Island. Now to a fantasy adventure take on the island's early 20th century history in graphic novel form. A pair of history buffs and colleagues have turned the holiday resort for Rockefellers, Vanderbilts, Morgans, and other American elites into ground zero for the Jekyll Island Chronicle series. It's a kind of Fantastic Four for the Gilded Age, and the second in the series is coming out next month. Ed Crowell and Steve Nedvedik are co-authors. Steve is joining us by Skype. Hello, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, and Ed is with us too. Ed Crowell, hello.
Good morning, Virginia. Good to talk with you again.
So we just heard a little bit about the origins of the Federal Reserve. What really was secretive? It could have been a spy novel or a comic. But why did you decide to turn this place, Jekyll Island, a storied place, into the ground zero, I can say, for a fantastic fantasy?
Ed, well, why don't you take that one?
I was going to say, I'll start in there. And Virginia, I think you had a hint of it in the conversation you just had. Jekyll Island was the summer home, or the winter spot, rather, for a lot of the rich and famous in the country. And people don't tend to think about it, but when you've got a group of superheroes you want to put together, or you've got something you want to do in new technology, you've got to have some financing. And so when we were looking around for who would fund our superheroes and fund our fantasy story, Jekyll Island came up as exactly the right place, because that's where the wealth was gathered at that point in time. We're in the post-World War I era. And so it was a natural, and of course, both being here in Georgia, we thought it was wonderful that we could set our novel in Georgia.
Well, all right. So how did you turn this figures from history, though, you know, these dusty figures that people may not know the names of, into superheroes of a sort?
Well, Virginia, our heroes in the story are more the fictional characters that we've created. And we've used the backdrop of Jekyll Island and some of these other characters, Carnegies of the world, Morgans, Teslas, Fords, people that might have gotten together and shared stories and shared technology and shared interests, although we know that in reality there was not that degree that we are painting in our picture, in our book here. But we wanted to do that as a backdrop and really focus more on our heroes, which are wounded veterans from World War I that our industrialists and our inventors kind of support and create this new wave of action heroes.
Well, some of them are based on real life people, as you said, and some of them are not, even based on people from your family. I believe Steve, Peter Karovic, he's a character based on your father and grandfather. Have I got that right?
That's correct. My grandfather was an immigrant from Bohemia, my grandmother from Moravia, and they came over during World War I. My grandfather enlisted in the U.S. Cavalry and fought. So I have stories from my dad and of his my grandfather's heroics, and I coupled that with my dad's heroics in the Korean War as a veteran, and we created Peter Karovic. Peter was my grandfather's name. Karovic is actually a family name for our third creator, Jack Lowe. So when you're writing your own deal, you can kind of do what you want, and that's the point.
Right. Exactly. So history has one place, and then the fantasy has another place. But why comic book form? I mean, why use this as a vehicle for telling a story that really may lead some people back to looking at history?
Well, you know, I think part of that is from our history. The three of us were involved, and Steve mentioned Jack Lowe, who's the other co-author on this. All of us were big comic book fans as kids. And to some extent, we never lost that love. And so as we got together and started talking about how to tell a story, the idea of a graphic novel really seemed to fit. Steve has a background as a cartoonist, so that's been very helpful, because he does basically all the layouts and helps put the put the flow in visual form as we move along.
Steve, you also have a theater background, from what I understand.
That's correct. I do. And so my love of the arts, I mean, it's been present my whole life. And I wanted to create with Ed and with Jack a story that was visually compelling. And so we found some great artists from SCAD who we have hired to be our illustrator and our colorist. And we use them to actually complete the book and the look for us. But the look is very much a highly stylized, what we call diesel punk. So it's the diesel era, but pushed to its technological limits. So things that weren't actually available or capable, we can work into our world. And we can get to design really cool machines and really cool inventions. And some are based on real life, like some of the work that Tesla was doing at that time in history. So we get a great chance to put together weird and interesting facts and kind of cool fantasy. And we throw it together in a book with a plausible storyline, and we enjoy having readers figure out what's real and what's not.
Steve Nedvedik and Ed Crowell, they are two of the three creators of the Jekyll Island Chronicles. One volume is out, and the next is coming out next month. Thank you guys so much for joining us.
Thank you, Virginia.
It's been a pleasure.
And that is our show for today. A couple of weeks ago, we interviewed Gray Henson from Macon, Georgia, who was nominated for a Tony Award for his role in Mean Girls, the new Broadway musical. Well, Gray did not win, but as we know, it's an honor just to be nominated. And if you'd like to go back and hear our interview with him, we'll post it at GPB News. And of course, we always want to hear from you. We recently talked about Syrian refugees coming to Georgia to escape that country's long civil war. We met one refugee who arrived here 2 years ago. Well, that conversation resonated with one of our listeners who told us about the work that she does helping refugees acclimate to life in the U.S.
This is Suzanne Vandermark. I have worked through my church with Syrian refugees. I don't know if our family is exceptional, but I would say they are, but maybe all the families are. They were most gracious. I feel like I received much, much more from them than I was able to give back to them.
Thank you, Suzanne, for your comment. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter or leave us a message at 404-500-9457. Our show is produced by Fenley Fox and LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is our senior producer. Susan Davis is executive producer. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Second Thought is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting.